Okay, what I'd like to do at this point is just to kind of talk about some things with you about your music, about the influences that you've had over the years and so on. Oni, would you mind telling me a little bit about how you got started in the music?
Well, my first recollection of hearing string music was my foster grandfather liked music, and he had an old open back banjo and a fiddle, and they had an old Victrola, and when we would visit into their home, I always looked forward to hearing them play those records, and they had records of Fiddlin' John Carson, mm-hmm. Gid Tanner and the Skillet Lickers, Ahaz Gray, and that in that period of time, see. That was those were the first string music that I ever that I had ever heard. Okay. And then in the 40s, my brother and some of the my brother Leon Newman and some of the boys in the community got interested in music, and they bought a mandolin and a guitar and a banjo, and brought it to our house, and they would jam there. And I might add, Doodle Thrower lived in Tallapoosa. I remember him coming out, and he would play with them some. He played the harmonica. But I was only about 7 or 8 when they first started trying to learn to play. Mm-hmm. And, of course, me being a child, I was supposed to leave the instruments alone. And I'd slip, during the day, I would slip that mandolin out because it was little. And they were trying to learn, they were trying to teach one of the guys to play Chinese Breakdown on the mandolin. And of course, I heard them sing it or hum it over so much, so I had learned the tune within my mind. So I slipped the mandolin out and learned to play Chinese Breakdown on it.
So that was the first song that you learned to play?
That's on a stringed instrument. Mm-hmm. And of course, after my brother found out I had learned to play it, then he was happy that I'd learned and he would let me play it. Now I have a cousin. Now, I don't remember this, but he has told me in the last year or two, two different times, he played the guitar too. His name was Thomas Johnson. And he told me that they used to make me sit up on the bed to play it for fear I'd drop it. Mm. Now, I don't remember that, but he says that they'd make me sit up on the bed for fear I might drop it. And, of course, in that was in the 40s, and when World War II broke out, well, everybody, of course, had to go, all the men had to go into service. And all of the young men went into the armed forces at that period of time. And, of course, playing the mandolin was not that much fun, you know, just playing the mandolin. So I kind of, I guess I don't really remember that much about learning to play the guitar, but I think I learned to play it out of boredom, mm-hmm. out of desperation. I was the only child left at home at that time, and back then we didn't have televisions, and young people didn't have cars to go any place they wanted to, so naturally I was at home at night, and mm-hmm. I'd get out on the porch and sing, and I learned to play the guitar, and that's the way I learned to play.
Okay, who were some of the early influences on you as far as the music goes, when you first started playing guitar and on up until mm-hmm. the Bluegrass Five?
Okay, well, of course, in my childhood, we had a radio, and my parents liked the music, and back in those years, they had country music or hillbilly music on the radio from the Atlanta stations. I guess it was WSB. Mm-hmm. And they would have music at lunchtime. So many people were farmers and were
Crossroads Follies.
And they would, you know, that's when they would be in the house, and they called it the Crossroads Follies. And when they would go to the house from the fields, they'd always turn the radio on. And so, of course, that's I heard music then, in which it was the Smith Brothers, and I always liked James and Martha Carson. They were always favorites of mine, and the Chuck Wagon Gang.
Harpo Tidwell played harmonica.
But that was my earliest, and then of course Jan and I married in 54, and we had met this, we knew this young man that lived near us, and they played country music, and they wanted us to play some with them, and, you know, form a little band. And we were singing mostly just, you know, country music. That was what was on the radio. And it was just called hillbilly music, I guess you'd say. They didn't call it country or bluegrass, either one back then. And anyway, we had been playing some, and they said, we know this fiddle player in Carrollton. We lived in Temple, Georgia at that time. Said, we know this fiddle player in Carrollton, Georgia. Let's go down and see how we like him, see if we might want to get him to play with us. Well, we came down to Jack Shirey's house, and he played old-time fiddle tunes more. Mm-hmm. And so we played with him, and or I did. Jan wasn't playing the guitar at that time. And I guess he liked my guitar playing. Of course, I played an acoustic guitar, and the rest of them played electric guitars. And he says, y'all stay on a little longer. Don't go now. And the rest of them had to leave. Said, there's a banjo player coming by. Uh-huh. And so the other boys had to leave, and right. Jan and I stayed on. And it turns out that the banjo player that came by was Joe McGuire. And that's when we met Joe, in which he was, we thought, a very good banjo player. He was always real modest and never, ever gave himself credit for being the good banjo player he was. But anyway, we stopped playing with the guys with the electric instruments and started playing with Joe and Jack. Mm-hmm. And we just played. We didn't call ourselves a band or anything, but we played for some square dances. And
this was during what, about what time?
That was in 55, I guess, wouldn't it be? Yeah, 55. And then, of course, Jan got drafted into the Army, and we left, and of course, we played all the time that he was in service. Mm-hmm. We met musicians and played, and Jan loved it well enough. He did good singing. He just had not learned to play the guitar, and he loved it well enough that he wanted to learn to play the guitar. And so he started with She'll Be Coming Around the Mountain, and he finally got to where he could play it. And we bought him a guitar while he was in the Army, so we'd both have guitars. And like I said, we got acquainted with the local people up there in Columbia County, and anytime they needed any entertainment, well, they'd get us. We met the other musicians out there. Of course, we got fed a lot of good meals from playing music.
Okay, and Mr. Baxter, now at this point, we've kind of covered the history here of Oney up until about the mid to late 50s, and so I'd like to go back now and also find out a little bit about your early influences, the kind of music you were listening to when you first started listening to it, and kind of like we just did with Mr.
Well,
Baxter.
She mentioned about the shows in Atlanta, Georgia, you know, with James and Martha Carson and all those people, and I listened to those shows. They were on at lunchtime when we were out of the fields for our lunch break, and they influenced me a whole lot on that. That's why I really enjoyed it. And there was a man from was a preacher from Bowden, Georgia, played had a bluegrass show on WLBB in Carrollton. And he played lots of the early Stanley Brothers tunes. And Carl Stoley, he played a lot of that stuff. And that influenced, that thrilled my ears to hear that kind of music. And then when Oney and myself married in 1954, while like she said, I got started learning to play the guitar two or three years after that. And we did country, like mm-hmm. she said, while we were in service, and then in 19 and 61, 2, and 3 while we switched over to bluegrass, and that's the first bluegrass band was, of course, Joe McGuire playing banjo, Huey Wiley mandolin, and Oney and me on guitar, and Howard McGuire on bass. And Joe played with us for a year or two, and he decided to, he was in the reserves, and he got called into service when they had the Cuban crisis. And Ron Norman started playing banjo with us, and he mentioned that there was a good thing going on in Asheville, North Carolina. They called it the Mountain Folk Festival. We went to the Mountain Folk Festival in 1966, I guess, 1966. And we heard some bluegrass music for the first time, people rolling bluegrass music like it should be played.
Right.
And we all set in to learn how to play and roll the bluegrass music like it should be.
Okay, now this is a good place for me to ask a question that really it seems to be a common theme with Georgia bluegrass. And I think it's maybe a little different than bluegrass in Kentucky or Tennessee or whatever.
Really, right after Jay and I married in 54, of course, we bought our first television.
Mm-hmm.
Flatt & Scruggs was coming to Atlanta and doing shows. See, they would do live shows. Mm-hmm. And I guess that was the first time we got to really see them, you know, and hear them, other than on records. And I remember one time in particular, they were announcing, they would do these shows in Atlanta, and then they would go out to the little towns, different places, schools, and do shows, live shows. And they said they were going to play a show at Pineywood School, which was in Cleburne County, Alabama. Well, I knew right where that school was because it was just across the line from where I grew up. And so we says, we'll go see Flatt & Scruggs. And that was the first time we ever saw them in person, in a little bitty schoolhouse way back in the backwoods. I mean, that's the way they did shows back then. And at that time, Earl was not with him. I think he had been in an accident or something. Mm-hmm. And he was not playing banjo with them that particular show. But nonetheless, we really enjoyed it. And
do you remember who was playing? Was it Curtis McPeak, maybe?
I think it was.
I think it was Curtis. Mm-hmm. They were talking. I mean, I know that old guy that played. I can't remember what he played. They called him the Little Darling.
He didn't play much of nothing. He just did
a bunch
of comedian work.
I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was either Curtis McPeak or that McCormick.
Haskell McCormick.
It was Curtis McPeak.
I think it was Curtis.
We're running into a little bit of a theme here that appears to me to be common with a lot of bluegrassers in Georgia. And this is, if you were playing during the 50s, you may have been interested in bluegrass, but you were really, a lot of folks were doing kind of classic country types of things, and then switched over really to what would, I wouldn't say necessarily hardcore bluegrass, but more traditional, or it was contemporary bluegrass at the time, Monroe, Stanley Brothers, Flatt & Scruggs types of bluegrass, as opposed to some of the older style Appalachian music that had been passed down, like from Gid Tanner and the Skillet Lickers, that kind of thing. What was there about the bluegrass that attracted you to go to it as opposed to staying with the acoustic country, traditional classic country?
I think it was a close harmony, three-part harmony, and the faster driving, hard driving.
And that banjo and mandolin.
Mm-hmm.
I love the banjo and mandolin. I think that added a lot to influencing us to go that route, because we enjoyed the harmony. I love good close harmony.
Okay. All right. I think we're probably up to about 61, 61 or 62, 63, sometime in there. the Bluegrass Five. How did that come about? How did that group come about? Was that your first bluegrass group, or was that the first group that you actually started going out and really?
I would say it was the first group that we actually went as a band. Like I said, when we met Joe McGuire, Ralph Shiro was a young man. He played the old-time fiddle tunes, and more so than the regular bluegrass fiddle tunes. But we met this fiddle player from over in Smyrna, Georgia. He was a friend of Joe's, named Roy Alston. Most everybody called him Slim. And we would go to his house, and he played more of a bluegrass-style fiddle. And we played quite a few months with just Jan and myself and Joe and Roy. And it turns out that Roy drove for Roadway Trucking Company, and he told us one Sunday when we were over there, says, I have this mandolin player that's coming over to play with us this afternoon. He's a driver for Roadway also. And it turns out it's Huey Wiley. And Huey didn't sing that much right at the time. He sang more lead. And I don't know, we just hit it off from the very beginning. And he said, listen, I have just moved to Douglasville. And of course, we lived in Carrollton, and it's not that far apart. And he said, I want y'all to come see us. And we started visiting, and of course, we got real close, and Joe was still playing banjo, and we'd do these little jams at different people's houses, and when people heard us, well, you know, they started wanting us to do these little shows then, and we said, well, we needed a bass player. Joe says, I have a cousin that lives in Douglasville that can play a bass, Howard McGuire. So we contacted him, and he started playing with us, and it turns out he was a great bass singer as well. And so Huey learned to sing the baritone, and we had a full quartet there from the beginning. And we really, every new song we'd hear, we couldn't wait to learn it. And we always tried to, when we learned a song, we tried to learn the harmony right. I couldn't stand it if two people were singing the same part, and I still can't. But anyway, they were always real good about that. And they had this Lee Williams from Bremen, was a disc jockey at Bremen radio station at that time. And he and his brother had this little, well, it was just an old shacky type building at Bowden Junction, which is a wide place in the road, but they called it the Wanda Auditorium. And Lee loved music well enough, so he started getting some pretty big acts in down there, because back then they were wanting to do any stage show they could do any place. And he used us on that show a lot. And he had Flat Scruggs in there, and Bill Monroe played there one time, and of course the Chuck Wagon Gang, and Wendy Bagwell. And can you think of anything else, Jay? Anybody notables?
No, I don't.
But anyway, he had those groups. Him being a disc jockey, he knew how to get in touch with them.
That's right.
And a lot of people in this area got to see and hear firsthand those good groups from him having that small auditorium up there, and the fact that they would play places like that back then. And then he changed and started working at WDGL, which is a radio station in Douglasville. Mm-hmm. Well, he continued to use us. If somebody contacted him for opening a shopping center or grocery store or service station or whatever, he'd get us to do the music for him. And he decided he wanted to start a Saturday morning radio show. We were already doing a radio show, so he wanted to make it a 2 or 3 hours long and use other people as well as us. And I think that long about then was when Tut and Ron may have heard us on the radio. Anyway, the first time we ever met them, they showed up over at the radio station.
Now, that was about what year?
It would probably have been around 64.
Yeah, it would have been around 64.
Around 63 or 64.
Yeah.
Okay, so the Bluegrass Five actually started playing as a unit about what year, 61?
We are saying 63 as the Bluegrass Five.
As the Bluegrass Five.
We may have been jamming, you know, and playing some.
And the way we got the name, they were doing hootenannies back in those days.
Oh, yeah.
And they had a hootenanny in Bowden, Georgia. Was going to it at a new gymnasium that had just got completed, and they contacted Howard McGuire, and they wanted us to play.
They wanted,
and so they wanted a name of a band, and Howard told them we'd never had a name.
Yeah.
Well, that's the way we come up with the Bluegrass Five. He said we're playing bluegrass, and there's five of us, so just put it down there on your paper, the Bluegrass Five. So it stuck with us to this day.
Well, I've got to also ask about the little theme song that y'all have.
Oh.
Who wrote that, and
Hughie,
how did it come
Hughie
out?
Hughie
and Joyce Wiley.
Okay.
And used the tune of Rollin' in My Sweet Baby's Arms.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they did they do that back early in the career of the group?
We did it quite a few times. It wasn't on every show.
He's talking about the early part when it started. No, it didn't start with the first of the Bluegrass Five. It come into being in the middle 60s.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's I think it's got some good history as to how you know, your early influences and this kind of thing. Now, in the late 60s, that was kind of a heyday for bluegrass. That was one of the up cycles and so on.
That's right.
And I know that y'all did a lot of festivals and so on probably during that time. Mm-hmm. What were some of the festivals that you played, say, in the late 60s, say the mid-60s to to the mid-70s, let's say? That was kind of a...
Really, I would say 65, 66, and 67 were some of our busiest years. We did the Union Grove Festival, Old Time Fiddlers Convention in Union Grove, North Carolina. And we did the Mountain Dance and Folk Festival in Asheville.
Right.
Back then, there was not that many festivals.
Exactly.
And then after that, we got acquainted with a lot of people, and we got a lot of exposure at those two places. And then, of course, we played a lot of the little schools and what have you. And we played the first Livonia, Georgia Festival. I'm trying to think, somebody said it started in 69, but I couldn't say for sure. And we played it for several years. We played Horsepin 40 over in Alabama. We played a lot of festivals in Alabama. And we played the Folk Festival in Florida, and we played Lodi, Florida one year, and of course we played all the local festivals. We helped start them, Armurchie and the Marietta Festival.
North Georgia Bluegrass Festival.
Uh-huh. And we played Hiawassee Mountain Fair too.
Uh-huh.
But the first time we ever played it, they were still having it in the old school auditorium. I mean, it was an old school. And then they started having the shows in a tent. And I guess the last year we played that, probably about the last year, was in 68.
Also,
or 69, something like that.
One of the more important things I think that we were involved in was the North Georgia Bluegrass Festival.
Okay, now I'm not familiar. Where was that?
That was the fairgrounds in Callaway Road in Marietta, Georgia.
Well, that's the Marietta Festival.
It's the Marietta Festival today.
Oh, okay. So that's had several names now.
Yes, it's had several names.
Uh-huh.
But the way it got started, well, like we've said, we were going to Asheville, North Carolina a lot, visiting with those people. Well, we wanted to host them back in Georgia, and so we invited them down to Kenneth Hood's garage and had a big picking there. And a lot of them from Asheville and in different states showed up.
At that time, there was about three or four bands in this area.
Mm-hmm.
Murray Freeman and Ralph Abernathy and the Dillard Rogers' boys. And Kenneth, they all had a band at that time. I can't remember. They'd
been going to Asheville some.
And we had a band. I guess Connie and Murray and them had a band.
Walter Butler.
And Dillard and them had a band. But anyway, that's the reason we had it over at Kenneth's. And we and a bunch came up from the Birches, Curtis Birch.
Right.
And them came up from Brunswick. And I remember our band fixed 500 sandwiches that afternoon. Murray Freeman was a sheet metal man.
Mm-hmm.
He made this big thing and parched peanuts, and we had a wheelbarrow full of parched peanuts sitting around. And one of the other bands furnished the drinks, and like JN said, they invited people from Asheville and different places, and we had a big crowd, and it turned out real good.
It was big, and Dillard Rogers says, I can get the fairgrounds at North Georgia Fairgrounds next week. Let's have a festival next year. Uh-huh. And anybody be invited. And we did that. And that's the way that this North Georgia Bluegrass Festival, which is called the Marietta, it's been called the Marietta Bluegrass Festival. It's been called Georgia's Best. And
but there was a period of time that it did not exist, though. They started it back in later years.
And it turned out that this it grew and grew and grew. At one time, it was drawing around 2,000 people into the fairgrounds, and which was turned out to be a real good festival, and had the name of having the best jamming of any festival in this area.
That was kind of the legendary grandfather, so to speak, of the festivals in this area, and the others were associated with them. During the period from, let's say, 65 to 75, are there any highlights that you can think of that you'd like to, that really stick out in your mind as the things that you guys did? I know that you had a lot of people. A couple of things that I think of during this time was that you had some people that wherever you performed, as I understand it, would always be there because they were big fans and so on.
Sure.
James Watson is one that comes to mind. And I'd like to hear a little bit about that, and then also maybe a little bit about that school bus.
I can tell you two good stories. We used to go to the DJ convention. You know, back then they didn't recognize bluegrassers, and back in those early years. And so the professionals would come just to pick like we did, just have a good time. And James Watson, of course, he always liked to go to that. Well, he followed us everywhere just about it. But anyway, one particular year, Jay and I had decided not to go. In fact, I was expecting a baby, and I decided not to go. And Huey and Ron went on, and James Watson, Everett Hill, and all day that day, Huey had called me that morning and said, are y'all still not going? And I said, well, I don't guess we will. But if y'all decide to go, come on. Well, before lunch, J.N. called home and said, have you heard from Huey and them? And I said, yes. He said, if we decide to go to Nashville, just come on. He says, well, now, if you want to go, we'll go. And I knew then that he wanted to go, so I just started packing, getting ready to go. I knew when he got off work, we'd go to Nashville. Before the day was out, Howard called and said, have y'all decided to go to Nashville? I said, I got a feeling when J.N. gets home, we will. And he said, well, call me if you do decide to go. So we all ended up going, and we didn't get there until about 2 o'clock in the morning. The jamming was just getting over. Well, James Watson and Everett Hill said, y'all might as well go with us because there's not any rooms any place. Said, we have a suite over at one of the old hotels. I can't remember which one. Mm-hmm. We got over there, and they had a little living room area and two bedrooms, I think. And I was the only woman in the suite, and there was about 10 men. Of course, I knew them all. And there was a rollaway bed that would just fit in a closet. Jan and I slept in the closet that night. So that was one of the fun trips to Nashville. And hearing about this old bus and school bus and converted it into a camper. That's what a lot of people were doing back in before these nice campers came along.
Right.
So they sanded and fixed it up real nice, and we went to Florida in it to the Folk Festival, and our family and his family went up to Missouri one time to a festival, and we were just going just for a trip.
Right.
And we got to jamming.
Jimmy Orchard's festival.
And we got to jamming up there, and they invited us to play on the festival. And we ended up, I think we were the first ones to start
play
the thing, play it, and then the last ones to
play on Sunday afternoon.
We were the last ones to perform on Sunday.
Opened it up and closed, and wasn't even scheduled on the.
We didn't even plan, but we met some nice people, had a lot of fun. But we went on that old bus. The kids played in the current.
And incidentally, we sanded it down and painted it purple.
Well, it was a magenta more than purple. It was pretty. And we made a trip to Florida in it. And it was just the band. The wives didn't go along. I think maybe Kenny, Hugh's son, was along. And we had played a show in College Park that night before we went on down. And Howard was always the one we picked on. You know, a band always has someone in it that everybody picks on. So we were going down 75, and the thing would run fast. Huey drove pretty fast, but on that trip down, Huey decided he'd play a trick on Howard. So he pulled the throttle out, and Ron was sitting right behind him, and he reached and got the steering wheel. Huey jumped up and opened the door right quick and said, "I'm going to jump," like he'd gone crazy. Of course, Howard jumped up and ran for the steering wheel. And he said, "On my way over there, I knew I had been had." But that was just one of the instances that we pulled on him. But he was always such a good sport.
Mm-hmm. He's certainly an excellent bass player and bass singer.
He surely is.
All right, now we're up to about the mid-70s, I guess. Looking from the mid-70s to the mid-80s, what kind of highlights would you look at as far as the Bluegrass Five?
Well, Huey and Ron and Howard, they left the band at the time with no hard feelings. We were blessed to never have any hard feelings with anyone. Now it's just been a blessing. And they left the band, and we got Mac Farley Jr., Ralph Abernathy playing mandolin, and Mac Farley Jr.